All right, here we are again.
Yes.
I don't think we need to introduce Hashi, right?
We're already halfway through the day.
All right, so Hashi, thank you for doing this. I know that you're talking to us today about gaming and Service Fabric.
Yes.
All right, so with that, I'm just gonna let you start.
All right, so before I start, I have a confession to make, right? I'm not a gaming expert, although I've been playing video games as long as I can remember, like Wolfenstein 3D,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, all those games. I love video games, but I did a few gaming projects, but I'm no way a game expert. So today, what I'm going to show is mostly my learnings in the few past projects.
Mm-hmm.
I will show you something that did work and something that didn't work, and actually most things didn't work. It will be interesting session, I hope. So let's get started. Do we see my slide?
Skip not yet. Title. It's coming.
Yes.
All right. There we go.
So today's agenda is really simple. I will cover three types of games. We'll cover turn-based games, which is like when you play a chess or playing some board game, you take turns to make your moves. And then we talk about interactive games. That's where the majority of the gaming experience, you're driving cars, you're shooting people, all those things. And then I will talk about how you host a legacy game servers on Service Fabric cluster. This is where you don't have any possibility to change the existing code, but you still want to get some quality of service offerings from Service Fabric, and how you would do that. And what's not covered, actually, there's a lot of not covered. So we are not cover about 3D programming, mobile games, game design, game AI, fraud detection, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
All these are interesting topics, and I hope we will cover more as we go forward. But today, we will just focus on these three topics. So let's jump to the turn-based games. This is one of the most simplest game you can imagine, but there are some challenges, some common challenges that you will face. The first one is authentication and authorization. When you have players playing against each other, you want to make sure they are actually representing the actual person. It's not impersonating someone else. And you also want to ensure fairness. Cheating is a big thing in the gaming industry. You also want to put protections so that people can play fairly in the games. And also, as you design a scalable game server, you need to make sure your server can handle multiple game sessions, and how do you host and manage those sessions effectively? That's another challenge. And also, many games, especially nowadays, have this mobile experience. You can play on website, on console, but a lot of people are playing games on the mobile experience. And expectations of the players have changed, right? They are not expecting like some dialed down version of the game on the mobile. They want the full experience. They want the whole, the complete frame rate. They want the whole package to be delivered on the mobile. Mm-hmm. So those are some challenges. And I summarized some of the practices that may help you, which is on this slide. So for authentication, basically it's a no-brainer. For most of my authentication needs, I will go to Azure AD, or in this case, I will use Azure AD B2C.
Mm-hmm.
Azure AD B2C allows you to take users from other identity providers like LinkedIn, Facebook, or Microsoft.
I'm guessing most gamers sign with Facebook accounts, live accounts. And
yeah,
so
especially
on
when
Microsoft
you play
account.
The mobile game. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a great technology for you to use. Basically, you are dedicating all the authentication complexity to the Azure AD B2C, and it will handle all the protocol dance for you and give you the token. And also for simple games, especially like the little turn-based games that we are going to introduce, there's usually a natural mapping to the game elements to actor model. For instance, you can model a player as an actor, and basically a game board, or if you want to go more granularity, you can consider each game piece as an actor. And if you think about, let's take a chess game as an example, right? When you're hosting a chess game, each of the piece, you only want one player to move it at one time. So the turn-based concurrency of the actor model actually gives you some kind of control, even though you may have multiple requests from the server, you can make sure they are actually taking turns. You don't have two players trying to move the same piece at the same time. So what I found is that the actor model actually works pretty well in a lot of such gaming scenarios. And I will also go through a little pattern called the turn manager. Basically, people will try to cheat when you play some board game. And the easiest way to cheat is to try to make more moves than the others. I'll just not wait the other player, just make as many moves as I can. And there's actually a very simple turn manager that you can implement using actors. Basically, it will ensure each player will get a fair turn of playing. And in terms of mobile clients, what I see the most successful game, they actually have a common API in the backend. So the common API will provide the game engine, game interface to all the gaming platforms. But on the mobile client, usually what works better are native clients. So you can use all the local devices and the graphic capabilities. And basically, you bring out the best experience to the user. But at the end, you're talking to the same gaming API. So you have this consistent experience across different platforms. So for that, I'm going to jump to the first scenario, which is actually tic-tac-toe. Tic-tac-toe is a very interesting game. It's one of the simplistic game in the world. And actually, this is one of the few board games that you can actually enumerate all the possible moves. So basically, you can write a game engine that is undefeatable, which is really annoying, but that's how simple this game is.
So that's considered a turn-based game, right?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
That's very important to keep in mind that we are in the turn-based space right now.
Yes, we are all in the turn-based game. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. So for this game, it's actually really easy to design. Basically, I have two actors, one representing a game session, the other representing a player. So two players will try to join the game session, and the game will make sure there's only two players in the game session, and it will manage the board as its local state, and then the client will query the board and display on the screen. And what I have in this is a little turn manager. Basically, I'm leveraging the turn-based concurrency of the actor. Basically, each player will try to say, this is my turn now, but the turn manager will by checking its local state, it will know which is the actual next player. So it will reject the request if you are not the next player. Actually, let me jump into the code, which should give you a clearer idea. We have the tic-tac-toe. You can see my server. I have the game actor and the player actor. And first, let's look at the client. So basically, my client, I'm using a single console application, but I'm starting two threads. Basically, I'm trying to simulate two players who is trying to cheat all the time. So they don't wait for turns. They just try to make move all the time. Mm-hmm. So let's see how it works. I'm going to launch this client. And they are terrible players. They don't read the board at all. They just try to make random moves.
Is the backend currently running on Service Fabric?
Yeah. Right. It's deployed on Service Fabric. So you can see, although these two threads, they are trying to make crazy moves every few milliseconds, the server is keeping them in order. You can see they are making turns, making moves in turns, and the server actually rejects invalid moves because these are very dumb clients. They just try to randomly put these pieces. And the server code is actually not that complex. If we look at let's look at the players actor first. This is nothing much. Basically, the players just have two actions. It's trying to join the game and trying to make a move. Yeah. That's all it is. And the gaming itself, it's doing some of our, probably this is not a nice code, but the one thing I want to show you is that basically to have this turn manager, basically it's just using a next player index state, and it's just incrementing and multiply by two, it will calculate the next index. And when it receives a request, it will compare with its state. If that request is actually my next player, then it will grant access if it matches.
And this is a reliable actor.
Yes.
Is it stateful?
Yes, stateful actor.
So that means if the node failed, actor, the game is still conscious and it knows what's happening once it's recovered, right?
Yes.
So that allows me to have the game running the end user, if I'm playing this with you, yeah, right, that we will not feel that this happened, that that kind of
feeling. Yeah, you won't feel a difference, right. Yes. Actually, and that's a good point. Actually, if you go back to the client, the way we create a new game session here, I'm just simply creating a random number. So actually, you can launch as many game sessions as you need. This is how you scale out your game server, mm-hmm, as the load increases. So that's a really simple demo. And let me go back to my deck. I already did the demo, skip to this. But that's the, like, the obvious turn-based games. Mm-hmm. There's another less obvious turn-based game is actually the real-time strategy games. If you think in the real-time strategy game, the players are not waiting for turns, right? You are making as many moves as you need. So it doesn't seem like a turn-based game. But why I put this game like the game like Age of Empire, the Red Alert, those kind of games, usually on those game servers, they have some implicit turn management. So it's not like you can send as many moves as possible, then the server just handle it. Instead, the server is actually running an implicit turn on the server. So each there's a frame for the server to accept user inputs. So all the inputs will be collected during that frame. Now after that frame, the server will start to calculate the next state. Mm-hmm. Then once the state is calculated, it will be synced to the client. So you have this constantly going implicit turns going on the server. And what you see on the deck is that basically in the blue frame, you're accepting commands from all the clients. And there's a yellow frame, that's where you check if all the clients are sending commands or if that some clients are not sending command. This means either there's a bad connection or the client just timed out or dropped off the game. You need to handle those cases. Then basically the key part is the green part, where based on the, in addition to the commands, the client is also sending you the connection speed. Mm-hmm. So based on the connection speed, you need to adjust the next interval of basically the next turn. The reason is this. So to have a fire game, basically you need to make sure the game works for the slowest player on the network. Mm-hmm. So if the slowest player is sending like only one command a second, so it makes sense just to, let's say, everybody can only send one command. So that's fair, right? Mm-hmm. But that will bring down the gaming experience for other users. This is why this dynamic adjust is important. As the client network recovers, it can send more commands. Then you can know for the next frame, I can accept more commands. So then this may make my game more smooth and the experience much better. So this is a kind of a dynamic adjustment. It actually applies not only to the turn-based games, but also to the real-time interactive games. You have to keep monitoring the client performance and do adjustments. And we will talk more about this, mm-hmm, in a moment. Then once you have the interval, you execute the turn. Basically, you render the state, then the state got pushed to the client. So I don't have a demo for this, but I think the concept is fairly straightforward. And with that, I'm going to jump to the second portion of this, which is interactive games. This is a fairly hard topic to cover because, the games, it has the most demanding in terms of a throughput, latency, mm-hmm, right? So for this, I'm going to focus on one of the games from our partners, the Age of Ascent, yeah, game. I think Cal knows really well about this game. You worked this game for the last build demo. Uh-huh. So they did a really impressive multiplayer online game. They have millions, they can support millions of concurrent users in a single universe. Mm-hmm. And they have 50,000 simulated players, but actually they haven't reached their upper limit yet. Basically, they can go higher.
So it was yeah, just holding on a second and understand why interactive games are hard. Mm-hmm. And let's not talk about it from gaming perspective. Let's talk about it. What's, yeah, happening on the server like that?
Yeah.
Is it hard because the number of connections,
yeah,
the number of traffic coming in and out of the cluster, yeah, the compute power, Why is it hard, or is it because of all of this happening at the same time?
That's a very good question. Yeah. Basically, it's a conflicting requirement. You have the, well, not necessarily conflicting, but you have the throughput and latency, right? Sometimes to reduce latency, you want to crunch things as quickly as possible, but that will occur a lot of network traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you want to batch messages together, mm-hmm. so you have higher throughput, but when you're batching things, that slows you down, uh-huh. right? You know, a lot of systems, that's kind of tolerable. I'm batching messages, so uh-huh. you don't get immediate response. But in the case of gaming, you want like response time and milliseconds response level, uh-huh. right? Any latency will just jeopardize the gaming experience.
And mind you, they do that, like gaming game server operators, they want to do that, and then at the same time, they want to have no downtime.
Yeah.
I want to do the upgrade while my game, my gamers are still on the game.
Yeah.
So it's a very hostile, demanding environment.
Yeah. Right? Really tough.
Let's see how Service Fabric fits in an environment like that.
Yeah.
And how does it scale up for that?
Yeah. Cool. Right. So let's go back to the Age of Sand. So basically, like I said, they are a large scale game. They send a lot of network packages per millisecond. You can see the data on the screen. And their tech stack is on the screen. I won't go through those. Actually, to give you a better sense of the game, I'm just going to play a video. That's a video many of you may have seen, but I think it's still fascinating to see that video just one more time.
We wanted to create a game of such massive scale that's never been created before.
We really wanted it to run naturally in the browsers. Anyone can play it immediately, whether it's your laptop or your phone or your PC.
We were building a system that could cope with huge demand and huge concurrency, huge availability. Around about the same time Service Fabric came about.
Say two alliances suddenly decide to go to war on a whim. They all meet in space at the same time to duke it out.
Our microservices in Azure Service Fabric will automatically scale up, begin unfolding space, and seamlessly distribute the load across all the nodes in the system.
We've tested it up to 50,000 concurrent players in the same battle arena. We were handling 267 million application messages.
So it looks like we have a typical audio problem. Let's reset and start the video again.
All right.
Yeah, the audio video guys are just telling us, restart the video.
Yeah, this is what happens when you do it live. But how do you restart the video?
Go back.
Just a second.
Our game Microsoft.
All right. All right.
We wanted to create a game of such massive scale that's never been created before.
We really wanted it to run naturally in the browsers. Anyone can play it immediately, whether it's your laptop or your phone or your PC.
We were building a system that could cope with huge demand and huge concurrency, huge availability. Around about the same time Service Fabric came about.
Say two alliances suddenly decide to go to war on a whim. They all meet in space at the same time to duke it out.
Our microservices in Azure Service Fabric will automatically scale up, begin unfolding space, and seamlessly distribute the load across all the nodes in the system.
We've tested it up to 50,000 concurrent players in the same battle arena. We were handling 267 million application messages a second.
Our game microservices are built using ASP.NET Core. It gives us superior performance. ASP.NET Core is open source that allows us to contribute back to it if we have any performance issues, which then Microsoft review, and together we make a better product. Our contributions to Kestrel have reduced allocations, lowered latencies, and allowed it to be already 2,300% faster than previous incarnations of ASP.NET, and more than six times faster than Node.js.
We run public player versus player alpha playtests once a month, where anyone can just drop in. All you need is a modern browser that runs WebGL, turn up at the website, and you can play the game against other players around the world.
All right. We are back. I hope you heard the audio because we don't actually hear anything from the studio. So that was the game. It is a fascinating multiplayer online game. And what I'm showing on the slide right now is their architecture. It's a high level view of the Age of Sand architecture. Can we actually show that on the slide? Yes. So actually, there are a couple of things I want to point out. The first is that the Age of Sand guys, they fully embraced the microservices architecture. You can see their games modularized into different services. This allowed them to evolve and deploy and scale different services as they need. Actually, in a moment, I'm going to show you a cluster and see how those services are laid out. And the other thing you can see, there's no centralized database. Like in the earlier session, we were talking about how the service fabric provides you a stateful service where you can actually distribute and keep your state close to your compute. And they are leveraging that in this sense. And also, I spoke to the kind guy from Italy, right?
Age of Ascent?
Yes.
Ben.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ben and James. And they gave me some pointers about the learnings and the practices they've learned from this process. I will just put the page there. We'll make the deck available afterwards. So basically, there are some practical techniques they used to scale out the application. But there's one particular thing I want to talk about, which is the state synchronization among the clients. Let's say when you have 10,000 players, mm-hmm. how do you synchronize the state of 10,000 players? That's literally impossible. But what they did was actually they used this space partition. But be aware, this is not service fabric partition. This is their logical partition. Basically, they're partitioning a space into smaller partitions. And when you partition space into smaller segments, you can do all kinds of collision detection, all the controls, all the state synchronization within that small area that will improve your synchronization. But there's a practical problem where you have let's just take this picture on the screen. You have two spaceships. They are in different partitions or different regions. But how do you handle their interactions? So what they have is called the primary partition, not service fabric partition. A primary space, let's call it primary space and secondary space. Basically, each of the spacecraft, it belongs to one primary space, but it also copies its data to a secondary space, which is the neighboring space. Mm-hmm. So all the decisions of a spacecraft is still made by its primary space, but the information is made available to the secondary space. So when the secondary space makes decisions, it can use that information in the read-only mode. It can use that information to make its own decisions. Mm-hmm. So this is a very simple but very effective pattern. Actually, in my book, I also cover this pattern. I call it coverage map. That's why you see on the slide, which I don't think is a good name. We should probably call it something else. But that's only solves one part of the problem where you have this edge conditions. We have more and more users eventually in the battlefield, not like everyone is evenly distributed in the space. There will be like a fierce combat going on in some mm-hmm. regions. You will have this unbalanced partitions. And what they do is that they keep monitoring the number of spacecraft in each of the space, and they will do dynamic partition. Again, this is not service fabric partitioning, but at the logical level, you can do the dynamic logical partition mm-hmm. so that in this case, because the B area has too many spacecrafts, I will just split that into two so I can scale out my application as needed.
Mm-hmm. And this is all done .NET Core, right?
Yeah, this is all .NET Core.
.NET Core, Service Fabric.
Yeah.
Everything is managed code.
Yeah, everything managed code. The client is in the WebGL. Uh-huh. They were using 3.js. Mm-hmm. They are migrating to
other platforms?
Babylon.
All right.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to mention is that also they did this trick. I mean, video game is mostly all about tricks, right? They did this trick where you have the close-up spaceship that is close to you, is interacting with you. So they want to give you the real-time state update for the nearby players. But there's also like spaceships far away from you. So they allow this variable refresh rate. So they keep this distance from the players. If it's if the distance is close to you, you get a faster refresh rate. And for the information far away, like there's some 100 spaceships roaming around in the far away galaxy, you get a little hint of where those boats are. So as actually you can see on the screen, so you can see the bullets and the aircraft are floating around you, but there far away you have a little cluster of information. Basically, you can see some far away spaceships. Mm-hmm. So as we are doing the gaming session, we have to do a demo because that's always for. We have to play games. So I'm going to jump to another demo, but this one will be really quick.
You just couldn't refuse the chance to play.
Yes, yes. Any chance I'm playing a game. But before we have the fun part, I'm going to show you the application. So you can see the Age of Sand is actually made up by multiple service fabric applications. Earlier, when we did the hyperscale web session, there was a question about if my application has like 50, 60 services, deploying the application may take a long time. How do I manage those things? So one of the practice as the Age of Sand guys did, you can actually segment your services into different applications. And each application, if you use the domain-driven design concept, it's a controlling context, right? It's a controlling domain mm-hmm. where basically it's isolated from everybody else. For instance, if you look at this artificial intelligence application, it consists several implementations of their gaming AI on the server, but it's pretty much by itself. And there's account management, other things.
Yeah. Yes? Just to clarify, this is the actual service, or this is the actual code.
Yeah, this right? is the actual this, we're
not, yes. this is not a mock-up, this is the actual game code.
Yes. Right. Actually, I'm going to jump to the cluster right now. I'll give a name, and I'm Cal. And actually, I'm terrible at these kind of games. You will see in a moment. Basically, I have no idea what I'm doing. But you can see all those simulated users roaming around. It's really fluent. I'm on a browser. I don't need to download any plugin. I can just jump in and play. Mm-hmm. It's a really good experience. And you have the mobile experience as well. And what other things the Age of Sand guys are doing, they are trying to provide this multi-view experience. So basically you can even set up your own enterprise dashboard. You can have the main screen, you can have the mobile phone to do the communication. And you can see to the upper left, you can see how many messages, how much data is pumping through this system right now. So I don't think I'm going to do anything useful on this. I just show you my terrible skills. And actually, if you don't mind, Cal, in the Build conference, we did this amazing demo of doing rolling updates and rolling rolling back. Can you just reiterate what we did in that scenario?
So Hanselman, Scott Hanselman, being goofy, the usual goofiness he has, he pushed an upgrade. So the idea is a lot of people were playing the games, mm-hmm. and he pushed a bad update, upgrade. Yeah. This bad upgrade is... say that using health reporting, the services were saying, hey, I'm unhealthy. I cannot respond to requests.
Yeah.
So Service Fabric keeps an eye during upgrade on these health reports. Yeah. And once it made sure that this is not going to go forward, it started rolling back towards the older, healthy version of the game.
Yeah.
And while he's doing that, we kept the game playing. So the idea is players don't see that.
Yeah.
And that's very important because everybody tells me that. I did a bit of gaming development, but I wouldn't claim, just like you, I'm an expert. But everybody says that gamers are very volatile, meaning if things doesn't go right, all of the time, they just drop the game and move to the next game.
Yeah.
So gaming user experience is very, very important for people like it.
Yeah.
And that was our demo.
Yeah, especially when you imagine like there's a literally hundreds of thousands of players playing on the platform. You don't want like break the system down either intentionally or unintentionally, right?
You usually hear about it in Twitter. That's what happens with big games.
Exactly, yes. Okay, so let's move to the next game, which is Unity Tanks tutorial. In case you don't know about this game, this is a tutorial from Unity. They use this game to teach people how to write games. So I take this one and I migrate the I created the backend on Service Fabric. But before I continue, I have to clarify that Unity does have their own network layer. So you should definitely check it out. The reason I'm using Service Fabric is just because I want to try a lot on Service Fabric. And at the beginning of the project, I set up a few goals. The first, I need to connect different players over the cloud so that they can drive their own tanks and shooting each other. Mm-hmm. And the second is that I want to leverage the local physics engine. The Unity has a fantastic physics engine on the client. I don't want to replicate that on the server. So that actually brings a few challenges. So I will just go through my journeys of implementing this server. Basically, I will show you four versions that didn't work. And one version is kind of working right now. So the first one, the first attempt, so basically I was thinking, okay, because this is a legacy client, I don't want to make much changes. So I will just cheat. I will just stream inputs from one client to another, and I will cross input streams, and then the client does everything. This actually kind of worked in the local network settings, especially if your network is great. But the problem of this is that you really don't know the state of the game. You have no idea what's happening in this system. Let's say one of the client, it loses 10 inputs, and that 10 inputs just lost. And as you play back the inputs on the other side will get a totally different state. And you have no idea to know, and you have no method to fix that, right? Because all you know are inputs from the different clients. Actually, I'm not the only, I can't say crazy, but I'm not the only person who attempted this. Actually, on the market, there are a few products using this way. Basically, they have those gaming simulators that they cannot change, but they want to provide a multiplayer experience. So that's why they do this cross-input trick just to simulate that experience. Actually, it kind of works in the local network. But of course, it doesn't work for the cloud. And the worst thing of this is that there's no way to recover. Once something went wrong, there's no way you can recover from this. Then I went to the second approach. Because syncing the inputs doesn't work, so let's sync the state. So the idea here is that each client will send his own state to the other client. It will just cross-import the states. So for instance, the tank A will send its location to client B, and client B will send tank B to the client A. The problem of this is that still you don't have a global state. There still will be state differences. Again, this works better than the previous method, but there's always some subtle cases that some collision detection happened on one client but didn't happen on the other client, then everything falls apart. And then I thought, okay, let's do this in the proper way. Let's have a proper server-side engine. The client will send inputs to the server. The server will calculate the next frame, and the frame will be synced to all the clients. This sounds great, but the problem is that it can't leverage the client-side physical detection anymore. Actually, for the collision detection of the tank and the shells themselves, those are easy. Those can be done. But the complex part is the collision detection of the landscape. When we launch the game, you can see there's actually a complex landscape of buildings, structures. I don't want to replicate everything on the server. So this thing didn't work out for me. Then I thought about, how about this? I will just pick one of the client as the server. Basically, I'm electing a host. I will do some kind of a peer-to-peer network. So one of the primary client will be doubling as the host, and the other guy will just stream the input to this host, and this host will calculate everything and send the frame back to the other client. This kind of works, but there's a problem of, I'm going the wrong direction. There's a significant host advantage in this case. Basically, one of the guys is running everything local. It's getting the immediate input, immediate frame feedback, but the other guy has to go through this long wire to send the input over and get frames back. So this is really unfair. It's like intolerable. It's really problematic. So then I came to the fifth version, where still I elect a host. So basically, I have one of the clients doubling as host. But in this case, I have a local input collector. So basically, this input collector, if you recall the earlier about turn-based management, it's basically serving as the same purpose. It's collecting inputs both local and remote. And then it will, after it collects the enough inputs per frame, then it will generate a new frame to both clients. So this will reduce a lot of unfairness of the electrical host problem. So for that, I'm going to show the architecture. Basically, I have the two clients, and on the server side, I have a gateway who provides WebSocket connections to the clients. Then the gateway just offloads the message to the backend engine. But in this case, the backend engine is really simple. It's during the game, basically, it's just relaying the input and the frame data. I have a separate actor, the game session actor. That's where to coordinate that you can only have two players join the same game session, the common administrative stuff. And I have this local game engine where it does this input framing and frame generation for both clients. So for that, I'm going to show you a quick demo of the game. Actually, I just realized I forgot to publish my server. Let me just publish this quickly. I was about to do this right before the demo, but I forgot it. Let's just do the local cluster. So you can see this is my game server implementation. I have my game engine, my game session, which is the actor that manages the game sessions. The gateway, which is provides the WebSocket communication layer. Actually, I'm looking at to change my custom gateway to the reverse proxy the Swiss Fabric team is providing, but that will come later. So I'm deploying this game is deployed, and I also have a test client. Actually, let me launch the test client first. So basically, I need two players to simulate the game, but it's kind of heavy to launch two Unity clients. So I wrote this little test client so I can simulate one of the players. So in this case, I'm going to simulate both players in the simulator. So I'm launching the game, it's joining the game. The first two lines is from the session manager. So basically, it's assigning a unique ID for each of the players. And then you can see how the input and the frames are streamed across each other. For input, I'm reaching about 650 inputs per second. And for frame, I'm getting 65 frames per second. But
that's local cluster.
That's a local cluster, but I do have both clients running on the same machine.
Yeah.
So that's roughly the performance I'm getting at this version. I'm trying to improve that, but probably it will be later time. So I'm going to show you the client, if I can find it. I'll show you the version one. So version one has some problems. It will be apparent in a moment. But let me just launch the two clients. And I hope my poor laptop can still hold up to the stress. And I need to get my server address. Which is actually, I'm using the local cluster at this moment. So because now it's a multiplayer game, I added this additional game loop for you to join the server. So you paste the server, you give your name, the Cal, session ID. You have to enter a session ID in this case, but let's create a new game. It's waiting for players. Join as Haishi. I'll join the same session. So now both challengers are online. Mm-hmm. I'll switch to one of the clients. So I will move, and you can see the state is synced. So the commands state are synced across each other. Uh-huh. But you can see this game is kind of lagging, right? You can see this very ugly moves of the client. But this is kind of something you have to compensate, because you are not doing this real time. The frames and the inputs are sent over as packages. There will be a delay. Doesn't matter what you do, there will be a delay.
But you can partition it using the same concept, like space partitioning, sort of that same pattern you spoke of, the map coverage map.
Yes, I mean if you're doing like many tanks.
All right.
Yes, the patterns I'm going to talk about is to specifically how to deal with this kind of lags, where you have separate packets, but you want to have this continuous experience to the user. So I'm going to actually, let me shut down this game quickly because they use a fair amount of CPU. I'm going back to my slide. And from current slide. So there are a few techniques you can use to improve the performance. The first one is the entity interpolation. So basically, you are getting frames from server. Let's say you are getting three frames from the server in this case. If you move frame by frame, you will have this jagged movement of your tank. But what usually happens is that on the client, you delay the rendering by one frame. Mm-hmm. And basically, after you receive two frames, you start to interpolate between the two locations. So it can provide this smooth transition mm-hmm. between the two locations. Actually, I think we are running low on time. If you have time, I will show you. I implemented this in the tank game, how you can have this smooth transition. But this actually creates another problem. This provides a better movement, but they actually add additional delays to your game because you're buffering two frames, then you render it. To deal with that, there's another technique called input prediction. So basically, as you drive forward, let's say you're driving your car, you can kind of predict where the car will be going. So before you receive the next frame from the server, the client will predict. Let's say the car is driving forward, I will predict the car will be keep moving forward. And once it receives the frame, it will do the correction as needed. So if it did the prediction correctly, perfect. If it did the prediction wrong, it will apply a process called a correction. Basically, it will smooth through the predicted position to the actual position. Mm-hmm. So just catch up with the server. So that's a very valid technique you can see in many games to do this kind of prediction to give you a really real-time response. And there's another thing is as the lag compensation. When, let's say, in the shooting game, you're aiming at a tank and you launch a shell towards the tank. But as your data packet reaches the server, the tank is already moved. Mm-hmm. Right? But you were aiming at it.
It's unfair.
Yeah, it's not fair. So what usually happens is that the server will kind of do the reverse interpolation on the server. So basically, if you take the locations of the tank in the next frame and the parallel frame, it will try to calculate the path between the two frames. Mm. And based on the packet of the shell, it will try to calculate when that tank was, mm-hmm. when the shell was actually fired. Mm-hmm. So that way give you a high precision control that you are actually aiming at where you are shooting at, right? So all those are valid techniques. And I'm going to show a demo. I think we still have some time, so I'll actually show in the demo how this interpolation works. Actually, I'm going to show the code. So this is the tank game. This is the client-side game. By the way, Unity is just awesome. It's unbelievably awesome. Mm-hmm. I hope I had Unity when I was young, when I was like 12 years old, when I was trying to write my own game. This is just, this is mind-blowing.
I always loved the tooling.
Yeah. So I'm going to launch the script. So by the way, in Unity, you code with C#, which is really familiar to a lot of people, and especially to our audience. I'm going to look at the tank movement script. So this is a script that controls tank movement. Just take a moment. And you can see there's a very smooth experience with Visual Studio. You can do debugging and everything. So let's just take a look at the remote move. This is where the location is streamed from the other computer and you want to apply it locally. The initial version, the version you just saw, the version 1, has one simple line. So basically, when it receives a new vector, it will just apply this vector as the new location of your tank. So that's where you see that jumpy graphics. But in the version two, what I did is I did this client-side interpolation. Basically, instead of setting the position to the target location, I will calculate the difference between my current location and the target. Then I got a vector. And based on this vector, I will normalize the vector so I get this speed, this direction mm-hmm. of where I should move. Then I apply the typical tank speed. So I'm marching in that direction with my tank speed. So this gives you a really smooth experience of the moving the tank. And I have similar code when you do the tank rotation. So the old code was just to set the angle so you can see this jacked rotation. But in the new code, I'm doing a similar interpolation on the client side. So I'm going to show you the version 2. Last night when I was trying this, it didn't work quite well because my computer was stressed. It takes a while to warm it up. Mm-hmm. Let's try my luck today. Let's see if this works better today. So I'm launching two clients. Mm-hmm. And I hope I still have the session. Go again, session one. Launching. Haishi, session one. I'm joining. And try. I have to move the tank closer before you can see this effect. You can see there's still a little jack, but actually, if you remember, it was much better than previous. And especially if you see the rotation is actually interpreted really well. You don't have this jagged turn anymore mm-hmm. like a robot, but you have this really smooth transition across moves. But as I did that, you can see there's actual delay. You can see there's a delay between the two clients. Eventually, they will be consistent, but there's an actual delay and paying the price for this smooth transition. So the next step, I will be implementing those light composition algorithms so it will be a better experience. So I have 3 minutes. I have another game to talk about. Actually, I have another category of game to talk about.
Let's dip through it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. We will go this really quickly. So hosting legacy game servers, this is where the case. You have a legacy game server. You cannot make changes, but you want to host it on cloud. You want this failover scaling, all those benefits. And this is actually quite typical in a lot of gaming companies. And one of the customers I was working with is Tencent. They have this title called Crossfire, which is kind of a Call of Duty kind of a game. They have millions of concurrent users. They have the maximum, they have 100 million, 10 million concurrent users daily.
That's based in China, right?
Based in China,
yeah,
of course.
That's why not a lot of people may not know about it because in China.
Yeah, the Tencent is one of the largest internet portals in China. And their scale of gaming and all the services is just phenomenal. It's unbelievable. So they have tens of millions of users concurrently daily. And they have data centers in all the major cities in China. So they have they provide this low latency to their game. And so they host a regular tournaments. They have a very large user base. And now we are working together trying to migrate the title to Azure. And the challenge, of course, we have is that we can make no modification to the game engine. Mm-hmm. I mean, the game engine is boxed system. So we are hosting the Crossfire engine as a guest application. On Service Fabric, and we are trying to gain the improve the quality of service. We want to support the rolling updates, and we also want to manage the multiple deployments where you see you can deploy a single version to multiple data centers and to improve density. And we are actually looking at how to use containers to containerize the game servers. So all this are in progress, and we have our first prototype built. So we have the game hosted on Service Fabric cluster, deployed on a local cluster. This is another benefit of Service Fabric. You don't have to use it on Azure. If you have your own infrastructure, like tens of data centers, by all means, just host the Service Fabric cluster on your own data center. And so I don't think we have a time to do a demo, but actually, I don't think I'm allowed to do a demo because it's kind of a bloody gaming scene. But just imagine, I mean,
it's an action game.
Just yeah, it's an action game that you shoot each other.
It's a method like for grown-ups.
Yes. So actually, that's all my content. I think I managed to be under time.
All right.
Yes.
So next we have CICD, right? And continuous yes. delivery with you. You're hosting the next
yeah,
one.
So next session will be CICD with me. Then you will come back for uh-huh. the migration, uh-huh. which is a very interesting topic. Then at the end, we are closing with the latest Linux and container stuff.
All right.
Yeah.
So stay tuned, guys. 10 minutes and we'll still restart.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.